welcome back to the Anger, Sadness, and Envy podcast, the podcast of Rampancy.net, Bungie Fansite. My name is Narcogen. I'm the webmaster of Rampancy, and I'm here with Blackstar of Blackstar Productions, as well as Miguel Chavez of Bungie Sightings. Welcome back, guys. And we're going to wrap up our coverage of ODST, given that now we're only 3 weeks and 3 days away from the launch of the public beta of Halo Reach.
Oh, do we have anybody on record as claiming the idea for doing the ODST truck?
The ODST truck?
Yeah. Do you remember seeing that? It was part of their
marketing campaign?
The multimedia thing. Drove around with a military vehicle with games in it, and they drove around and hijacked little kids to come play.
That I was there at the one in Long Island.
Oh, you did, and you survived.
Yeah.
Did they say who came up with that idea?
Yeah. I forget. I mean, it was all done through Microsoft Marketing, and they hired one of these companies. I really don't remember.
Oh, okay.
Them
so
offhand.
It was outsourced. So it wasn't an internal Bungie thing then.
Yeah. No, it was one of these things where someone thought about it from Bungie, and then marketing kind of took off with it. And then
must have been Doug Zartman.
And then one of these other guys, I think it was one of these Kismet things, because then this firm had gone to Microsoft saying, you know, do you want us to do something for you? Because they, one of the guys was a big fan and had thought about taking the one of these army surplus vehicles and retrofitting it with the video setups inside. I actually interviewed the guy for like a good half hour when I went to see it, and he was telling me about it. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Just asking him, you know, whose idea was it? And he, you know, this one guy made it sound like it was his brainchild in the actual acquiring of the truck and. You know, the direction which it went, and he said that Bungie kind of they looked it over and they had some minor tweaks here and there, but that pretty much it's as is, you know, that they pretty much liked it as he presented it. So, and he was the one that was going with it like to every single stop, so it was pretty cool.
I'm actually looking at the different scores that they had for when it came out, and I'm wondering the one like dissenting ranking I would probably say is Games Radar. They gave it a 7 out of 10. What's up with that?
So I guess some people just won't have to be, you know, kind of, they have to have their own.
They can't, game vision.
They can't.
I don't know.
Is
Games Radar run by Cody Miller and Hawaiian Bird?
Well, that's just it. I want to find out. No, I'm just curious because of all the listings here, of the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, say, you know, over a dozen, 15 of these different review sites. of course, that's it. Probably say, you know, 1/6 of them are all probably run by Microsoft. But the rest of them, I'm just curious as to they're all pretty consistent. You know, A-, B+, you know, ranging from 8s and 9 out of 10s.
I think it may just be their system. I'm looking at that review right now. It lists 7 as good. The story itself has got some interesting things. It says that the absence of the Master Chief in ODST is controversial.
Explain that to me.
Controversial as in the fanboy, you know.
Well, I was just curious because I had read reviews, and it's funny when you actually break them down and then equate them with other ones that they've done and other game types that they've done. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a lot of these people are, you know, textbook PC game shooters or Unreal Championship fans. They love anti-gravity and carrying 60 guns and having unlimited ammo for all of them and whatnot, and they get sucked into these player and game types, and that's what their expectations of joy is. And when you get something a little different, even though it is an FPS, their expectations are not met, and then suddenly, oh, well, the game sucks because of that. So you can't really say that that's a true evaluation or a review of the actual game. It's more of a reflection as far as to what their particular enjoyment of first-person shooters and the type of one that they play. And I think ODST has been a very, very different one. You know, it's kind of like the redheaded stepchild in the Halo universe. And I have to say, I enjoyed it a lot more than the original Halo 3, to tell you the truth. And I'm curious as to whether or not I also fall into that category of my expectations after seeing the trailers and seeing the story and seeing how they were setting this thing up as being, yeah, this is a little extension. You know, we had an idea of an add-on pack or a little thank you to the fans, and we decided to go in a little different direction here. And as some might see, you know, the lack of Cortana and the Master Chief is controversial, I find it, you know, just an offshoot of the same universe and the same ideas that Bungie's always had, just kind of a different flavor of them. So I'm just curious as to whether my enjoyment of this particular game being higher is because it is a better game, or it simply had aspects of it that also, you know, cater to my particular expectations of what a good game should be. And I'm wondering if Reach is also going to be reflecting that in the future when people are talking about bringing back elites, not understanding their, you know, verbalizations and getting them more scary, and details and game types that, and weapons, shall we say, reflecting more so of what people enjoyed in the original Halo. Nobody ever says Halo 1. They say, well, we remember Combat Evolved, pistol, and how much people enjoyed that, and we're going to try and reincorporate that into ideas with Reach, because of some of the things that they tried in ODST didn't work or quite as enjoyable as people's expectations might have led on to be, such as, say, Firefight, for example.
Yeah. I'd also like to look at how this project, being differently, being that it was a small team and was envisioned as an expansion, if there's something to be learned here, is it the idea that that it's a shame that Bungie did this because, given that they don't have pricing control, that it was pitched as an expansion and then sold as a full game, and then maybe that's what caused some of the disappointment. Is it a shame that that happened, or is it a shame that they don't do more of these? Given that, you know, it was produced in only 2 years, it was the existing engine. You know, each one of the Halo games up until that point had basically had a major engine revision, you know, from Halo 1 on the original Xbox, then the Halo 2 engine on the same platform was a big change, and then for the Halo 3 engine, they had to not only do the graphical upgrade, but also do the upgrade to the Xbox 360 using a completely different processor. But this time, we've basically got a tweaked Halo 3 engine and a small team just generating a bunch of content, maybe not as much content as they could have done if they'd had a full 3 years, but still a reasonable amount of content. It just happens to be priced the same as Halo 3. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that bothered a lot of people. And the backlash that came from that, is it a shame? I mean, do people look back on saying that and say, okay, Bungie really shouldn't have done that? They just should have, you know, either made it a full game or not done it at all. Or is the shame that, gee, it's too bad that people had that reaction, because it'd be really nice to have more smaller games more often built on the same engine so that you don't have to have all new technology to release a new title.
I would definitely go, I would go with the latter, only because it's of the two the scenarios, it's the one that could reward the player with extra content. You know, it's and it's kind of like it's the old, you know, they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. There seems to be no other way for them to try to get. I mean, if we are to actually buy, I take it with a grain of salt that they really just kind of sat there and says, hey, what are we gonna do? We got all this time to kind of kill. You know, I don't think you make those kind of business decisions so casually. I mean, I think it was hinted that there was some other, I think it was the Peter Jackson project, that when that kind of folded,
Yeah, that, the Halo Chronicles.
Yeah, Halo Chronicles. Yeah, when that folded, that's what left this team with time to kill. But still, I wonder, you know, I mean, I'm sure that these questions which you're asking or that are being posed kind of must have been going through their heads as well. You know, like, is this a risk worth taking? Not just in terms of their risk, you know, their standing with the fan base, which I'll readily acknowledge that they do understand that, but I also think it is a business and they got to figure out what they're going to do with their time and money and their resources, you know, the person hours which they can use up. But I'm glad that they did it, only because, you know, even if they lost some of the goodwill from the fans, some of it was out of their hands. I don't think it was Bungie who decided to jack up the price, and which was like unfortunate. And you know, I really think that Microsoft just, you know, whenever they hear a Halo, their eyes kind of get really big and they want to,
you know, and you turn know, into dollar signs.
Yeah, yeah, they really want to try to milk it as much as they can, and I don't blame them for it. But I think that's kind of the. That's kind of what the blowback is. Then is that some fans get really annoyed that it wasn't. It's, you know, when they mentioned the whole thing about the chief not being in it, you know, that. I mean, how can you fight that? You know, like, well, come on. You know, it's like everyone would have to kind of sit around a campfire and say, okay, let's take it easy now. I have this one thing about this new thing which we're working on. The chief's not in it, and you have to, you know, you kind of have to cuddle with them and say, listen, it's okay, we're trying something new. You know, it's like it's really kind of frustrating. You know, I think that we're saying that with Reach is like that it frees them not having to deal with Cortana and the chief, that this kind of frees them with doing some more things, kind of hearkening back to Halo 1 when no one knew anything about the chief and Cortana. And I think that applies also to ODST. They didn't have to follow along with the whole myth, you know, the mythology of the chief and Cortana. So I don't know, man. It's a tough one.
I'd have to say overall, I mean, the two things on the pricing and the chief. One, the pricing. I really didn't think that $60 was that big of a deal. I think I said it before in a past podcast or was mentioned before. I'm really surprised that the $60 was that. Big of a contention. Would people have been happy at $40, at $49, at $35, $52? I mean, where was the line drawn as far as, okay, well, I'll only pay so much for this game because there's only so many levels and so many people and the free beta and all the other maps before if I'd never bought them, you know. I mean, it seemed silly because bottom line is, hey, wait long enough and it's going to get real cheap. You'll find it $30, $20, and someday it'll be in that $5 bargain bin somewhere. So you know what? If you're really strapped for cash, hey, just wait. It'll still be the same game a year and a half, 2 years down the road.
Well, for the campaign it is, but remember one of the advertising, one of the promotion points for ODST was the new multiplayer mode. The firefight multiplayer mode. And if you wait too long, there won't be anybody online playing those games, you know, so you won't be able to get that.
Don't have any friends anyway. But as far as the beta goes, I mean, if you just wanted to get into the beta, you can get an ODST copy for, what, $20 now?
Yeah.
And it's not coming out until May. So from $60 to $20, well, if you'd waited, it's still the same campaign game. You can still play ODST online, and you're still getting into the beta. And it only costs you $20.
I hear that you can buy Halo 2 now for $5 and you have about a week's worth of multiplayer.
See, there you go. So, I mean, wait long enough.
Right.
As far as the Master Chief thing goes, I'm sorry, so effing what? I mean, there are so many other interesting characters in the Halo universe that they created. I think it would be a travesty if you could only play the Chief forever. Mm. I'm sorry, that gets real boring real quick. I mean, we've already been playing with him with a decade. That uniform is and suit of armor must be getting pretty ripe by now. Let's move on, people. I mean, I was hoping they were actually going to give him kind of a glorious death, or some kind of an out where the character would either be retired or whatnot. And they kind of did it nicely, where he just kind of, you know, rides off into the sunset of another planet there. That I think was kind of cool, because they wrapped it all up, tied it in a neat little bow and say, okay, we're moving on here. So them coming up with a whole new Reach thing, it's like, hey, people, you know, in this crew, nobody from ODST is in it. Is anybody complaining about that yet? No. And there's absolutely no way, even from their own storyline, that the Chief or Cortana could be in it. Well, at least marginally. I'd have to go back. It's what, 20 years earlier? I don't think Cortana was even made. And the Chief is off doing other things. So, yeah, the whole non-Chief thing, I think, is just, you know, a non-issue that people just like to make a mountain out of a molehill. Because running around with a gun, you're just running around with a gun just because you happen to be somebody else. And I kind of like the flavor that they put in with ODST, where you were playing different Marines with different missions and different aspects of the same story from different perspectives. I like that. And I'm kind of hoping that when they talked about the Delta team group coming out for the Halo Reach people, that they're going to do the same or a similar thing, where you're going to be able to play as those different characters at different points along the same storyline. I think they tried that.
Is there any hint of that, though? I thought the only thing we read was like, and you play, you know, you play this guy, the new guy.
Yeah, but, you know, they may do the same thing with Reach that they did with ODST. They may do an offshoot. They may do another side thing afterwards, a quote-unquote bonus pack.
What do you do in co-op? Who do you play in co-op? Like, does one guy play the main character and the other ones are playing different members of the squad?
Exactly. I think that would be kind of cool, to tell you the truth. I wouldn't be surprised if they do that. But as far as the point of how often or how, you know, the range of different title releases goes, with ODST, I kind of like the idea of a small team that was put together and said, okay, you got a year, let's see what you can do. And they cranked out this little thing that just, you know, exploded. And it's something, you know, that I really, really enjoyed, and a lot of other people did too. It was certainly bigger than an expansion pack, and yeah, it was smaller than a full-fledged title. To be honest, I kind of equate that with Portal. Portal was, what, 3 to 5 hours? It was rock solid, and it was just the right length, not enough to get boring, but you loved playing it.
Right, but
that's how I felt with ODST. It wasn't too long, it wasn't too short, it was just right.
Sure, but Portal, they didn't sell Portal for $60 by itself.
Sell ODST by itself. Get the extra bonus maps, and you're getting a multiplayer beta of a whole new title.
Okay.
I
just have to say, I'm not one of those people who thought that ODST was more expensive. I've said before that I would pay a subscription fee just to get every, I mean, at least while Bungie was doing it. I think the shame maybe is that they didn't produce this until the end. You know, there was never any really ambition aside from the Chronicles project to make Halo an episodic type thing, the way Half-Life became, or at least the way Half-Life was envisioned to become.
Yeah, right.
Well, I kind of hope that they take that Half-Life mentality and say, okay, we're going to come up with more titles more often.
I think it's too late.
With smaller prices.
It's not going to be Bungie, though.
I think it's too late. It won't be Bungie. I wouldn't pay a subscription fee for everything that's being put out for Halo that's not Bungie, unfortunately.
No, I don't think a subscription fee is the way to go, but having a game come out, say, like every 2 years or a year and a half or something is ODST size.
Yeah, I don't mind ODST size. I ordered from Amazon and they dropped the price to, what, $52, you know, before it even shipped. So, it wasn't a full title price. But on the same side, I have to say that as in terms of value for money, you can't really put ODST up against Orange Box. Orange Box was just, especially if you hadn't bought the previous stuff, was just such a fantastic value, not just because of Portal, which I think by itself is just as long, if not longer, than ODST, but also, you know, the two complete Half-Life episodes plus Team Fortress as well. I think maybe what it is that they delivered a lot in that one package altogether, whereas for ODST, it's kind of spread out. You got the best benefit of ODST if you didn't already have all the Halo 3 map packs. It was going to also give you future access to the beta, plus the ODST campaign, plus Firefight. So it's not quite as much as you get in Orange Box, and it's more spread out. Like for me, Orange Box was a good value because the only other Half-Life title I owned, I mean, I don't game on the PC anymore. I think it's hilarious that Valve is bringing Steam to the Mac, now. Like, so yeah,
better late than never.
Yeah, I was wondering, does that mean the original Half-Life? We finally get the original Half-Life on the Mac that antenna head locked up inside a safe? I mean, are they really going to do this? I might buy it just for that because I never played the original Half-Life all the way through because I never had a machine that could play it.
Well, now you do.
But I do think that was more value for money. That's not a knock on ODST, but you know, because I didn't own the only other Half-Life title I owned is that I did buy Half-Life 2 on the original Xbox.
Which is not as
high quality in terms of the graphics.
Maybe. I mean, as far as content for content, tit for tat, maybe not. But in Bungie's defense, Bungie didn't release several previous titles that were already made. I mean, that's what Valve did. They decided to throw in, oh, hey, we'll throw in our other stuff that you've already played and already bought before in this as well for all the people who didn't, just so people can have a clue as to what's going on.
Well,
so,
but they were going to release episode 2 with it anyway. It was just a question of like, okay, we can also give you episode 1. So
yeah, but I see Portal and Team Fortress 2 as being the two bonuses. And the equivalent of that is, yeah, one of them is kind of a half game and the other one is a full game in and of itself. So, yeah, so technically, okay, they're one game up as far as what Bungie's release is, considering Firefight technically isn't a whole game, and ODST is, you know, 75% of a full release title. Either way, though, and the beta is the bonus stuff, and the maps is the bonus stuff. So, yeah, so technically, maybe not. But as far as the concept of saying, okay, we're going to be including other things in here besides just ODST, they did it, and I think that is worth the equivalent of what a regular game title is.
Okay, so I think we all feel basically that it's, you know, that it's fine that Bungie did this, and if anything, maybe it's a shame that, you know, I want, and I think Miguel also really wants Bungie to move on to something else now. Halo belongs to Microsoft. It's really kind of a shame. I almost kind of wondered if there was going to be a Bungie spinoff. I mean, you remember a few years ago there was this controversy with ID Software in terms of because half the studio wanted to remake the original Doom and half the studio wanted to make something else. And they were able to hold the group together. But before, you know, groups have split off from Bungie. Double Ought split off from Bungie because they wanted to, they wanted to do Marathon Infinity, and Bungie was going on to do Myth. Now Bungie has all gone off by itself. Microsoft keeps 343 Studios, and it looks like they're actually hiring people who are, because originally when I read the stuff about 343, it looked like okay, they're going to do marketing and toys and the movie and some other stuff, and now they're actually hiring game developers. Looks like they're going to do more games. I don't know. Are they going to do more shooters? I don't know. I mean, it looks like they probably will.
Well, wouldn't they be the ones who would be taking the finished Reach engine and do the extensions to it, right? I mean, I suppose so. Yeah, that's what I would imagine. Is they're not going to let that die on the vine just yet. They're probably gearing up for whatever new DLC could be coming down the pike in the next 6 months to a year, I guess.
I think I would just feel better about it, I guess, if Bungie, having gone independent, had split itself into two camps. You know, the camp that they came on to Bungie because of Halo, and they want to keep doing Halo because they're not tired of it yet. And then the other group of Bungie who were like, okay, you know, a decade of one video game is enough. Let's do something else. But here, maybe I'm just paranoid. The idea of that second group, that Halo specific group, being in Microsoft and not really involving any of the original Halo development team or the original Bungie people, I'm just not so sure. You know, I mean, it's never really a question. I don't think I ever really considered, okay, I'm not going to buy ODST because of any of these reasons, because it's not the same kind of game, or because it doesn't feature the same characters. You know, I put a lot of stock in Bungie, and because it was Bungie game, I bought it, and I was not disappointed in any way, really. But would I have the same attitude towards whatever other games, you know, if what you say is true, if 343 Industries takes the Reach engine and decides to release additional DLC on that, not made by Bungie, I don't know. I mean, I'll give it a shot, but I don't think I can say right away, like, oh yeah, I'm sure it's going to be fantastic, and I'll buy everything they come out with.
Yeah, no, I think it would be for us, for our type of fans, players, I guess Halo appreciators, we probably approach it with some trepidation. And but I know that I would be crossing my fingers that they could pull it off, because that would be nice if there is some group of people who would shower it with the kind of love that you would want it to have, and then let Bungie, you know, that's us having our cake and eat it too. You know, it kind of keeps, just like you were saying with the subscription model, it's still there, it's still alive, it's still kind of percolating here and there. And but then our favorite company is doing some new things, and you know, we kind of move on. It seems like Bungie for the longest time has been trying to do a two-track, three-track sort of business model, but they can never do it. They can, you know, as soon as they try to divide their time, it never really seems to pull off. You know, Oni kind of did it almost, but even that was, you know,
in the sense that it did get released. Yes.
Yeah. Although. And it did get some accolades. I enjoyed it plenty. It might have been ahead for its time in the whole fighter and shooter kind of thing. But you know, so this would be like one way of us having that, where an existing piece of IP of theirs gets handed off to a company who hopefully will not, you know, drive it into the ground and just, you know, throw out DLC for the most, you know, craziest of reasons, and kind of still give us something that would be kind of nice. And then at the same time, we get a taste of something, you know, we can finally see something that has Jason Jones' name on it, you know, and maybe get into some new stuff, which would be really interesting. But
well, what are the redeeming bits of ODST for us then? What are, cause for me, actually, I think there were a lot of memorable moments in that game. We spent a whole episode last time talking about the first level, which I actually replayed last night, and I still really enjoyed. In fact, to review, I had my mind to set that, okay, it's a short game. I'll start up a game on normal, and I'll just run right through it, you know, just so I see everything. And what happened is that right after Tayari Plaza, the next Dark City Street segment, when you know it opens up and you get access to the bigger area, and it's dark and the music is moody, I found myself slowing right down. The music was kind of spooky, kind of, you know, a little bit Resident Evil type of soundtrack. And I found myself slowing down and peeking around corners and listening for things. And, you know, I found I couldn't rush through it, and I didn't want to anymore.
Were you looking for the tapes?
I have to admit, no, I was not. I did find them all in earlier playthroughs. There was, I think, one that you had to jump up on a vehicle roof to get to. There was no other way, and that was the last one that was hiding from me. But I have to admit that for me, there's less incentive the second time around to go and get those. I guess at least part of the reason I got them was so that I could hear all the audio logs, and that so that I could get the achievement for getting them all. And after that, I think actually if you on following playthroughs with the same profile, they don't even show up.
Right. Yeah. It's already considered.
If you're in a co-op game with somebody who doesn't have them, then they show up. But
Yeah, I just didn't know if, like, when you were saying you were slowing down the second time around, if it was kind of because you heard the little tinkle of the coins and the
coins.
Yeah, and that kind of starts getting you like, oh yeah, that's, I gotta go over there, and you know, and I can see that, you know, kind of drawing you back in. And you're right, that, you know, they did capture a really interesting mood. I don't know if I would, and I think this is what I said in the previous podcast. I don't know if I'd call it film noir, but definitely it was a nice kind of interesting, it kind of fit with your normal, I guess, kind of walking pace that you would be doing in this kind of a dark, you know, city where you're not sure what's around the corner. The music and the mood and the lighting and the environments, I think all lined up real well.
Yeah, I'm hoping they can put some of that in reach, because I remember there was a quote from Marty saying that, you know, from the first trailer and the soundtrack for the first trailer, the whole audio-visual background for ODST was rain. And then that later when they got into the development, the programmer said, you know, I'm sorry, we couldn't really implement rain. And that, you know, then they had to just, you know, so like you can hear the footsteps splash in puddles, and there's some fog, but there's not really rain. There's no downpour, no rainstorm, not like you get in that launch trailer, which is really nice. I'm hoping they can put something like that into reach. Halo, because Halo 3 had the same issue, right? There was that storm level where it's not really a storm, it's a light drizzle. I like the parts of Gears that have rain. I thought that was it's really kind of a nice effect. It'd be nice to see if they could put something like that into reach with the new particle system, because there was one thing they showed off where, you know, huge numbers of particles, and so maybe they can do it now. Thousands of particles.
In Halo 1, we were only allowed 100 raindrops, and in ODST, we have thousands. We can have an actual cloud burst.
Well, I think it's one of those areas where technology really does have an impact. I mean, there's really, I think, too much focus on, you know, on number of polygons and a lot of stuff that really doesn't impact gamers directly. But that is one area when you look at, okay, that ability to have particle means you can create weather, and weather creates emotion. I mean, that's...
See, that could be something that that 343 could... I mean, I think that's a perfect example of us being able to savor that. Like, so Bungie moves on. They weren't able to do it. Let's say that in Reach, their eyes again get too big, and, you know, they add all this other stuff, and rain again kind of falls by the wayside. And then maybe 343 comes in and gives us that one piece of downloadable content for $6 or something that actually is where they're able to turn on the rain, and they are able to give us a really moody level. And that'd be kind of neat then, you know? So here's hoping.
I think that was one of the original questions that they asked way back when. I remember a poll that Bungie was asking on HBO, and they were curious as to what some of the audience feedback of what they would like to see in the next game. And I think the first reply that I made was actually weather, was to actually implement some type of system where you could actually see during a level it change as you progressed. And we actually got that in Halo 3, and I was impressed. I mean, I can remember in the sections where we first started driving around and all of a sudden you go into a rainstorm and you got a chance to see the lighting change slightly and the clouds come in and change slightly. And I was like, okay, wow, this is actually setting up a mood. It gave a level of realism that you didn't quite get, because in the original Halo 1, you had particular levels or sections that were the environment you were in. You were either in interior hallways, you were outside in the snow, you were outside in a desert, and nothing ever changed. It was that. It's like you were on an individual planet that had one weather system, and that was it until you got to the end of the level. And I like the fact that they decided to figure out a way to at least give the appearance of it changing up or it progressing or modifying as you went along. It gave an extra level of realism to it, I think. And I definitely hope that they're actually able to pull off the same trick, if not better, in reach. In ODST, it definitely you get a singular feeling, especially in the introduction, for most of it, of that rain-drenched, soaked, battle, hardened or damaged city that you've got to kind of, crawl in through like a rat trying to find your way out. And it does change slightly as it goes on, where you get into, different sections in the interior, and they had the ice-coated under computer sections, and the exterior where you see the battle sequences going on through the highway sequences and stuff, where the city has changed after the dawn came up. So it wasn't quite as dramatic or as interesting, but it was still there. They knew that they needed to have different moods and did change it up slightly. So yeah, so I'm definitely looking forward to see exactly how far they take that in the next one.
I have to admit, I realize it's a minor feature, but I'm a real sucker for weather. Not just what they managed to do with Halo 3, which is to have some transitions, but to have a truly dynamic system where, you could stay in one place and time passes and, the position of the sun changes and the weather changes, like what happens like in Oblivion RPGs, like, games like Oblivion and Morrowind, those kind of games where, the lighting can change drastically in one location just because of the passage of time, not because you progress on the linear, Fallout doesn't do it as much though. Fallout has day and night cycles, but not so much weather. Yeah. And I think it's just part of that environment they do that they don't ever really, do rain or anything like that, but Oblivion does. And Morrowind before it also had the same thing, lightning, thunder, and rainstorms and that kind of stuff, sandstorms in other areas.
That gives me an idea, actually. I was curious. It reminds me a lot of the old Halo 1 guys that used to do all the moddings and the different triggerings of different points to get different reactions and stuff out of the engine and how things collided and interacted. I'm curious as to whether if they actually ever did implement something like you describe, whether you could actually, hold up and wait for, say, like the sun to go down and suddenly the environment and the whole tactics of how you would approach a level would completely change. Or the opposite, if you're in the middle of a night level and you wait for the dawn and suddenly the whole level completely changes, the same way Assault in the Control Room and Two Betrayals is the same level, and yet one's during the day, one's at night.
I think if they ever had something like that, I think they abandoned it pretty early. I think that when you look at the original Halo 1 video, where it looks like you might be looking at procedurally generated terrain, where you might be looking at a huge area, a game that had a heavier focus on exploration and travel rather than on straight action, and I think pretty early on they set the focus on that, and those elements I think got removed, and so the weather and time of day in Halo 1 is directly related to the scenario, and so the passage of time doesn't affect that. You can't wait for it to get lighter. It won't get darker if you take too long, that kind of thing.
I think they've also from their documentaries and such, they've stressed how much they sweat over the shadow maps. And right there, that kind of the precludes any sort of organic, changing of that. They try,
You can't have that level of fidelity, and that's why a lot of times you see in RPGs like Oblivion and Mass Effect, although they do look great, sometimes there are effects that can't be achieved because they have to allow for more dynamic lighting. You've got to have a huge range of lighting environments that you have to support with the same set of objects. And a lot of times there are glitches that happen. I think in those games as well as in Halo, sometimes you see, one object that's been moved from its original location and no longer appears lit properly. One object that was in another area and has been moved and now is glowing as if it is lit with some light that there's no source for.
It's interesting if there was any way that they could technically incorporate two separate shadow map designs together so that it would be more of a seamless representation, and that way you could actually do a transition like that and you wouldn't run into those problems. That'd be an interesting technical achievement, I think.
About the city streets, since that's where most of the atmosphere comes in, one thing I noticed, seeing as I've been playing a lot of other games since ODST came out, you know, I played Mass Effect 2 and I played some of the Fallout expansions, and so getting ready for this podcast, I came back to ODST, and one thing I noticed is about the city area, because in the first level, the first city sections before Tyari, basically your travel is very limited. They don't give you access to the whole city. You've basically got just enough to familiarize yourself with your new tools and your new interface, the map, the visor button, the health, how things work, and they funnel you, you know, pretty efficiently towards the next encounter, the first flashback, which is Tyari Plaza. And after you finish that, then they open up another door and you get access to a much wider area. And I thought that logically what you'd expect is that as you played ODST more and more often, your dependence on the map would drop a little bit. In other words, it could be kind of a curve, you know, where when you first start to play it, you really need the map because you need to know where all the flashback areas are and where all the routes are. And then as you got more and more familiar with the city, your dependence on the map would drop off a bit. Say the way it would be in Halo 3, and that, you know, when you play it for the first time, you don't know where you're supposed to go, and you can play faster later on because you already know, you know, you know what the encounters are, you know things, how are going to work out, you know the routes that you have to follow. I actually found that as play goes on, as the city opens up more and more, you actually end up becoming more and more dependent on the map, just because so many of the city features are reused. There are so many of those plazas that look very much like each other, all the doors having the same design. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I actually like the map feature. I like forcing the player to kind of stop and consider, okay, which way should I go now? And giving him an indication of where the enemies are to say, okay, I want to go this way because there's more to fight and that's what I want to do right now. Or I want to go that way because it looks like there's less to fight over there and I can get to the next objective more quickly doing it that way. Go around this pair of hunters instead of fighting them if I don't have any good weapons to fight them with at the moment.
Yeah, I it's interesting. I think that's a really good point, and I think you've pointed out I really wonder if that was something if they attempted to make the city more different in section by section, then someone pulled it in, or if they just had to do that for whatever resource reason, you know. But like, how big do we think, or do we know, is the plaza? Is the city of Mombasa? Is that like a virtual mile, or is it bigger? I think that they once kind of.
I know it's not to scale.
Right. Yeah. No. Of course.
Because I actually tried to take there were some people who pulled together some screenshots and made an overlay of the city map, and those locations that they talk about, you know, Kazinko Boulevard, Kikawani Station, those are real locations in the existing Mombasa.
We're right.
Just assuming that these were renovated and the newer city was built up over it. And although the relative positions sort of work out, the scale doesn't. I mean, the distance between those locations in the real city are much, much further than they are, you know, in the game.
Right. I think that there was a trick where you could get it to, you know, how it'll pull up the little, this is the where you want to go kind of marker. And then as you get closer, the meters, you know, shorten or they increase. And I think there was some way of figuring out just virtually how many meters away the entire city, encompasses. And anyway, my point was just that, if you were to lay that same amount of acreage over a typical modern city here, you know, I've been to a few big cities, you know, that I live in New York City, been to San Francisco, been to Chicago, I'm sure some other, Seattle. And I wonder, you know, is that even realistic to assume that something that big would be that repetitive, you know, like a, it's too bad because like you say, it should really not be that consistent from sections or is this, or do we,
ever been to any cities in the Soviet Union? I can tell you they're entirely capable of being exactly that repetitive.
Well, see, that's good. Now I know that there maybe is, you know, an architectural limitation or style. And again, we are talking, what, 500 years into the future? More than 500 years.
They could be more cookie cutter, I guess, in the future. I think what it is that most of the places I see that are that repetitive are not that big. They're repetitive because they're, you know, residential neighborhoods that were built en masse with a bunch of buildings all in exactly the same style, and the only difference between them is the numbers. I suppose, you know, I don't know whether they're making a conscious statement to this effect, but it may just be that, you know, that these are kit buildings, you know, mass produced in parts that are brought in and assembled on site, and so they're all done to the same design, and maybe that's why. I tend to think it's just more an artifact of the development process, is that, you know, it was more efficacious to build a certain number of these units and then use them as building blocks to construct the city. And they do a lot of things where, you know, one area is just a flip mirror version of another area of the city. And they do try to place some unique items. Usually it's damage, you know, like there'll be an area where one building is broken and on fire where it's intact in another part of the city. Crashed vehicles, that, you know, there's one area where there's the Banshee. There's the other area where there's the crashed drone. Right. That you can use as landmarks. Mm.
But do we know what the backstory is with New Mombasa itself? Like, is it, how new is New Mombasa? Is it, you know?
I don't know that there's ever, there may be someone who's done that out.
Yeah.
But
you know, because I guess you, just like how you're explaining, I guess it could be, you know, was old Mombasa destroyed? Was it part of some war or something? And so they had to build, redevelopment had to occur quickly. And so, just like you say, they have to bring in, they don't have much choice or luxury in trying to make the city this sprawling, unique center. And then instead it just becomes this, like, well, you know, we got money coming in, we got to build up and let's get going. So anyway.
Okay. Now, if we were playing in order, and I guess just mean the preferred order, because after that first level, there's you know, several different places that you can go, and you get some, you know, I don't want to say non-linear because it's not really that non-linear, but for a lot of people, I think their favorite area, I think if I had to pick one, my favorite area of the game was Uplift Preserve, just because I think one thing that really distinguishes Halo from other games is the vehicle sections. You know, there are plenty of other AAA shooters that either don't feature vehicles at all or just don't implement vehicles as well. Plus, I tend to like doing vehicle sections without vehicles, and that, you know, that you get a whole different experience doing that. So I thought Uplift Preserve was great. And the thing that really struck me about it is that if you play it enough times, there's always some arbitrary restrictions in an outdoor area that make you wonder why you can't go somewhere where, when you're on foot, you know, there are a lot of areas that are indoors. You know, it's you know, really kind of obvious. Okay, I'm going down this corridor. There are a bunch of doors. Most of them are locked. I'll go through the ones that are open, and that's the path that I follow when I play. when they give you a vehicle, though, they have to come up with other ways of saying you can't go there. In Assault in the Control Room, you know, you're in a deep valley and there are cliff walls. When you're driving outside in Halo 3 on the storm, well, it's a cliff edge. You know, you're driving along the edge of this cliff, and so you can't go out over there. But a lot of times it just seems so arbitrary. And I thought Uplift Preserve is kind of a stroke of genius because they put it in a wildlife park. And so the restrictions are built into the design of the place.
Right.
I thought it was a neat kind of meta commentary. You know, you're playing in a play area that is designed as a play area, exactly with the restrictions.
Right.
The restrictions being there to handle the animals and the tourists, and in this case, they're handling you.
Right. And what's the one thing which is missing from this level that's always been missing from there?
Ambient life. No, well, you know, it's funny. I did happen to be looking for some ammo playing that level last night, and I came across a pair of dead zebras.
They're zebras.
I never noticed that we're there.
Yeah.
And there's cages everywhere, but I guess the animals
have all escaped, or the grunts have eaten them, or the brutes have eaten them, or what? You know, who knows? But I thought that was kind of funny. All right.
Now, there aren't bones, but there are slaughtered animals.
Yeah. No, it's a fun level. I don't know if I'd call it my most favorite. I think my most favorite is the one where you end where everyone's got their rocket launchers and their missile launchers and you're just getting the ghosts are all around you. I'm sorry, the banshees are all circling around. I thought that's the most hedonistic, you know, let your freak flag fly level, but this is definitely a fun one too. I think also because it starts. Isn't this the one that starts? Am I confusing this with one of the other levels? Where it starts kind of dark, or no?
No. It's actually probably one of the brightest levels in the game. Right. It starts off with Dutch, and let me use this as a way to bring up another point I was thinking of, which is about the flashbacks, where they try to use elements in the city street sections to connect to the flashbacks, you know, these clue objects that you're finding. And in the clue object that leads you to the Uplift Preserve segment is this bit of crashed drone camera.
You're from Mickey.
And when you find it, you see the flashback, which is one of these drones flying over the preserve area, and you see Dutch down there on the beach. This is where, you know, this is where his pod is crashed.
That's right. Okay, I remember now, yeah.
Yeah, and at the end of the segment, when he's escaped from the wildlife area, that's when the drone camera crashes near him.
Right.
And that's the object that he finds. Now, I don't know if they're necessarily saying that the rookie, you know, watches any video that was in the drone. Obviously, he can't be expected to know what's happened to Dutch just because he sees this object. And, yeah, and I think that's what bothered me about it. I liked the idea of there being some kind of a detective story, but just like the film noir atmosphere is not really film noir, this is a detective story that's not really a detective story because the rookie isn't functioning as a detective. A lot of the connections between the objects and the flashbacks are really very loose.
He's more of a tour guide than anything else.
Yeah, they function for the player. Like I thought the best one was the connection to the detonator, the Oni Alfie site object, because knowing that there was an explosive expert in the group and seeing this very specific object, which was the remote detonator, at the end of an exploded bridge, you could reasonably expect that character, the rookie, could guess at what had happened. That the UNSC Marines had blown the bridge, that Mickey was part of that, and that this was a detonator that he had used to blow that bridge. And you could guess the scenario up to that point, you know, the Covenant streaming over the bridge, the Marines retreating over the bridge and into the building. And that all makes a kind of organic sense that, okay, he can detect, he can guess from the object and its position and its context what has happened to those characters. But most of the other objects, you really just can't.
Well, I have to just say that the plazas, the very first section, I think this is where everyone gets a little bit confused. That's where you find Dare's recon helmet. And so if we've been following the game from Halo 1, we know that the helmets have a recorder. So I think that's where everyone first thought, oh, I see, when I pick this up, I'm actually, you know, I'm putting on the helmet, or I'm taking out the little chip and I'm playing back.
Yeah, you're jumping to my point in early.
Thank yeah, you. And you're kind of watching the film of whatever, although, you know, obviously it's,
there is a, you know. There's a problem with that, though. The problem with that is that it's Dare's helmet, and Dare spends the entire time locked inside her own pod, which she mentions several times. And further, what they keep as a mystery, both from the play, you know, from the player, from the character, the rookie, as well as from the Buck character, is that we don't know what's happened to her. And if we were really seeing video recorded by her helmet, we would at least know what happened up until the point where she took the helmet off. What we really see there, and what we see at many times during the game, is video that's been recorded by the superintendent, because he has cameras everywhere.
Oh, right, yes.
So right. What we see in the Tayari Plaza flashback is the trajectory, the explosion, you know, of the engineer when Buck arrives, that blew the helmet up into the wall screen in the building. Now, I guess to me, it's an open question. Okay, if the super has cameras everywhere and he can see that, and he could maybe show that on a screen to the rookie, why don't we see what happened to Dare? Why do we only see what happens to Buck?
Right. A very flawed game, not worth $60. No, but you're absolutely right. This is the kind of thing that you almost wish like Bungie had just simply said, "You're not, you know, this is not due to the superintendent. This is not due to the object. You know, you touching it, and all of a sudden you're, you know, some sort of electrical transference of memory is being given to you. It's just simply a literary technique, you know.
Midichlorians, yeah, it's a metaphor. and I think people got hung up with that a little bit too literally, and I don't know whether it was because it was they were so used to the foundation that was laid in Halo 1 with the Jenkins cam video. And thanks for bringing that up, Meg. I was going to mention that, because I always saw ODST those moments with as an extension of that same one, because that was a really pinnacle segment in Halo 1. That's when everything changed, was you finding that particular recording, and suddenly the Covenant was no longer the problem. You know, that was, you know, to use a poorly done phrase, a game changer. So these things in ODST where he finds the different elements around, I never saw that as him figuring out a mystery of what was going on or taking place. Because I think Narcogen actually said at one point, when he saw the bent sniper rifle hanging from the wires, that particular artifact, there was absolutely positively no way he was ever going to ascertain what happened with Buck and his team prior to that, just from that artifact and its location.
No,
and I never really saw it as that.
It's really too specific, and that's right. Where the contrast is between the detonator. I think it's, I don't know, maybe to me it just seems more reasonable for him to assume that the detonator was related to the explosive expert they have, because it's not that common an item. I mean, I don't know that every team of Marines running around has a demolitions expert, but certainly there's got to be plenty of people with sniper rifles. And so he reaches up and sees this, you know, this sniper rifle bent into a U-shape that belonged to Romeo, who was in a fight on the top of the police headquarters
with a brute.
And had, yeah, exactly, had the hammer, a brute hammer strike bend this rifle that then falls off the building and hangs up on this wire. And it's not even a question of whether the rookie could figure out what happened. The real question to me is that how can he even tell that this object is of any significance whatsoever.
So in other words, how would this move him on to the next level then?
Yeah, you would, this, it's,
because recon, because Dare's recon helmet, you can obviously say, okay, I found a clue, it's time a special to move object. On. Right, and then in an uplift, what's the, so an uplift, he finds the drone, so does that, so does that, would that then spur him on to go to the next level? Yeah, I see what you mean, yeah.
It's also questionable, but at least with the drone camera, what you do have, and again, we don't know that the rookie is seeing any of this, that the super recorded anything, but the Buck character mentions that they want to use the drone, they want to connect to the drone network so that they can see where the other pods landed. And so that's why it's most likely, for instance, that you're going to play the second level in order, and so that's the next thing you're going to see. So you in the first flashback ends with Buck saying, "We need to find the drone so we can find the other pods," and then that's the next object that you find that leads you into Uplift Preserve is a drone camera, and the cutscene that opens that level is drone footage flying overhead.
Right.
So even if they don't connect the character, they at least connect the player, and the object at least is as special. I mean, I assume there are not as many camera drones as there are sniper rifles in the field.
Well, I'm looking at the next level, and the Kazingo is with the beacon there is the Gauss turret.
Yeah.
So there's another one that kind of
I was going to bring that one up. That one is so ridiculous and arbitrary. The first time I played through that, I didn't even notice that object. I didn't, because what happens with that is that as you're entering the final section before you have to abandon the tank, there's this little quasi cutscene that involves an exchange between Dutch and another Marine, and the Marine is on a turret and he's saying he wants to get ready to shoot, and Dutch is telling him no, he has to wait, he's going to give away his position, and of course, you know, he ends up taking a shot, the turret ends up getting destroyed, and he's killed. But while all that is going on, if you're not waiting with the tank right by the door, there's units coming at you from another direction. The Banshees overhead that are shooting at the turret are also shooting at you. There was so much going on in that scene the first time I played it that I paid no attention to what was going on. I didn't see the turret. I think it was only after that entire encounter was over that I noticed it over there while I was scrounging for weapons and stuff before going into the next section. I did not make the connection at all. I think it was only the second time I played it that I really was able to tell that I was in the same area. And the significance of the turret, I just didn't get it. I couldn't remember it being in that position. And part of it is just that as the rookie, you approach that from the, like a lot of the objects in a lot of the areas, you approach it from the opposite direction. You're playing. So when you go past that turret, it's behind you and to your right in the tank. It's really easy to overlook that whole area. And because my major objective after I played that level was to figure out how to get the tank into the next area, I didn't spend a lot of time on foot going back. It was only afterwards, when I was just messing around, that I went back into that area on foot, and then I happened to notice, oh,
there's a turret.
Oh, this is the area. Yeah, here's the turret. This is the view that the rookie has of the turret when he sees it up there and has to find his way into the building.
Yeah,
as the
rookie's going to be here in what, 6 hours or whatever. Yeah, he'll be here tonight.
As Mickey, I never bothered. You know, it was several playthroughs later that I even bothered to go back into that area on foot and saw.
Right.
Oh, okay, that's the building with the turret, and I can still go into those doors and I can get up there, but I didn't need to.
So would it be safe to say that this is something that Bungie, I mean, we're obviously nitpicking it to death here, do we think that Bungie never really intended it to be, it was only meant to be kind of a casual connection, or do you think maybe they initially tried to actually make it more more relevant, I guess? Or
the way they always described the way the development of ODST went, you know, with the shorter schedule and the smaller team, and the way it was originally planned to be something pretty small and then grew and become bigger. I tend to think that the idea was not that they really intended to do a complete non-linear detective story with a, you know, with a tight through line where all these objects were going to be related, and you were going to have to figure out the significance of an object so you could know where you're supposed to go next. And then it got scaled down because they couldn't do that. I just tend to think they had a number of areas that they wanted to create. They had a number of scenarios that they wanted to do. I think they liked the shift between the daytime and the nighttime, and they needed to find some way
to link
connect
them. Yeah.
And that's why I think some of the connections work really well and some of them don't work as well. I think it's interesting to note, maybe on this point, just talking about detective story, that another Bungie spinoff, Wide Load Games, is now doing an actual detective game for the Wii.
That's right, yeah.
Which is a Guilty Party.
But that's more like a long, like a Clue kind of game, right? It's it's like a family game type of thing.
Yeah, no Flood, no Covenant.
Right.
Just Scooby-Doo and Daphne by the look of some of the art. It looks right. Like they've taken a lot of cues from Scooby-Doo there.
The modern Scooby-Doo, the sort of, yeah.
Yes.
Right, so I mean, should we keep going with the other beacons and see if there's do any of the other ones work as far as you can recall, or do they all kind of fall on their swords, so to speak?
I think the ones that I really remember are the ones that work really reasonably well, and that's Dare's helmet and the detonator, the sniper rifle for the police headquarters, and the turret for Kazingo Boulevard. Those don't work as well.
I'm seeing the Kikuwani station as the biofoam canister.
That's just, it's that sequence also I thought was really kind of strange. One, just because it's such a nondescript little item. You know, one assumes that, you know, any squad of more than three or four soldiers, you know, would have one or two of these with them for emergencies, right? It would be a fairly common item. And the way it gets thrown into the rookie's path is so strange,
right?
The Romeo is hurt after the encounter with the brutes on the roof of the police station. They're now trying to go into the subway to get out of the city. They're hiding from a phantom overhead, and they retreat into a building. They close the gate behind them, but not completely. And then Romeo tosses the canister towards the partially closed door, and it rolls underneath and outside. And I thought, if you're hiding from the enemy outside, the last thing you want to do is create some motion,
or to leave a trail.
Yeah, or to leave a trail. So why did they close the door only partially, and why did he throw that object? It just seems so arbitrary that those two things happened, so that that object would be there, but that so that you could not go into that door yet.
Yeah,
and that's also my least favorite level in the game too. I'd say if there's any level that I'm tempted to try and skip.
Is the Kikuwani station?
One. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Basically, I think for two reasons. One of which is that I'm not a big fan of the revised Banshee,
mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that the Scarab at the end of that level,
right?
It makes sense to me, or at least a certain amount of sense, that in Halo 3 and in Halo 2, that that when Scarabs are around, that if they're aware of the Master Chief character as a Spartan, that they would focus on him when he is visible.
When he's close, or yeah, when he's with when they can spot him.
Yeah.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense to me that a Scarab should key off a single ODST in a group, especially when all the other members of that group are in a hijacked Phantom. So the Phantom is indestructible. It can't destroy it anyway. But then this Scarab, you know, is ruthless at at sniffing you out while you're trying to, you know, run around on these corridors and pick up a Banshee so that you can get to the other side and hijack it. And I just thought, I mean, I realized it would have been less difficult. It would have been less challenging if they had made the Scarab pay less attention to you. But to me, part of the thing that's interesting about this story and why I kind of objected to the implications of the text crawler is that this is a smaller story. It does not have huge, broad implications. You are not a unique super soldier.
Right.
You're just, you know, okay, ODSTs are elite soldiers, you know, better than regular Marines, but you're just one ODST in a group, in a small group that, you know, it's on a certain kind of mission, but it's not the kind of thing where, you know, the Covenant have to kill the rookie because otherwise he's going to assassinate a prophet or, you know, destroy an entire fleet. It's simply not on that kind of level. Why this Scarab should be so interested in me? I was kind of like, felt it was really unfair.
That goes into one of the complaints, and maybe this is channeling Cody now, or some of those other folks, is that basically the game, there's no point in the game, because at the end, you know, when you're flying away, you know, after Data Hive, the place just gets blown up anyway. You know, there's just like you're saying, you're not the Master Chief, you're not. There's nothing hinging on what's actually occurring here as being anything other than just a recon team trying to, you know, find each other and then just get the hell out. So I think that's what you're kind of saying there. Like, you know, there is no do or die, or the fate of the world or the universe hinges on the... on the team, you know, getting back in touch with each other.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind a failure. Like, for me, I mean, I think they didn't really do that, but I wouldn't really have minded if you had had a very ambitious, very important mission to achieve. And then, of course, what happens really early, right, is that things go wrong, right? They're not involved in the assault on the carrier. They have another objective. But the unexpected departure of the carrier throws everything off, to the point that, you know, really until you get to Data Hive, it doesn't look like you're going to even go on this mission at all, right? The mission objective is just scrapped, and everybody is separated, and the rookie's mission seems to be to link up with everybody solely, and the Buck character also specifically states that he's forgetting the mission. What he's really going to do now is he wants to find his men and get out of the city, and that's all. I think, though, that Bungie may have felt that that wasn't enough, either for them or for the player, and so you do get to go on the mission as the end. Rookie takes the place of Buck there with Dare going into Data Hive to get the engineer, but I think maybe they tried too hard to make this seem too significant. Like it seems like the real significance at the end of this was the engineer. But the engineer wasn't with the superintendent. I mean, that was not the mission. Dare was not sent there to retrieve the engineer. She was supposedly sent there to retrieve data in possession of the superintendent, supposedly relating to, I can only presume, the mechanism of the Ark, you know, that was in this cavern underneath where the superintendent was. And that's the bit that you see in the legendary cutscene ending. So I think the chain of causality is just too long and too weak. You can't build this up to be the most important mission of the war. You know, there's never any hint that anything the engineer tells anybody is of any significance. The Covenant ended up finding the Ark and using it anyway. It seems like the only significant data that the superintendent could have had was about the location of the Ark, which happened to be right there anyway. So, you know, even if the mission had been to destroy the superintendent so that the Covenant couldn't get their hands on it, it wouldn't have prevented them from finding the Ark.
Right.
because it was right there.
And what about, so with Truth arriving, I'm just trying to link all this up. So Truth is just, he's just simply like arriving there, and when Halo 3 starts, the Chief meets him there, like within a day or so, right? I mean, isn't that the idea, is that timeline-wise, it's happening almost, like the Chief's going to arrive very, very soon anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And I have to, the first time I saw that scene, my immediate reaction was that it was supposed to be regret. And then, of course, oh wait, that can't be, because regret's already dead, right? His ship left at the beginning of the game. So this prophet has to be Truth. So this is Truth returning to Earth afterwards, before activating the portal to go to the arcs. So yeah, this is somewhere where Truth has landed. The Chief has jumped off the ship, you know, and landed in the jungle, and he is now working his way towards that location. Presumably, there has to be some Covenant team that's going to go down through the city into this mechanism to activate it.
Right.
And actually, I kind of thought that would be part of the gameplay segment of ODST, would be a failed attempt to prevent the Ark from being activated. And of course, we get close to that area while we're down in the data hive, but we don't actually go into the Ark. I thought that maybe we would get to go into it, and we'd actually see some more, you know, more Forerunner type areas that we never got to see in Halo 3, because presumably they're down there.
Right. So do you figure with your idea about failure, do you think it would have resonated a little bit more if maybe, you know, I guess flipping it around, the missions are to gather up all the team members, and then maybe the last level or so, we start to slowly lose the team members, and maybe that would inject a little bit of urgency. Like, for instance, right after the data hive, I mean, the data hive, that really is a pretty tough level. I mean, those bastards are pretty good with their plasma rifles and all that, you know, and their speed and so. I mean, I think that would have resonated a bit more if all of a sudden I spent all this time I got to live through the life of Buck and whoever, you know, the other guys, Dutch and so on, and then here I'm now actually finding where it sucks that I'm not actually the Chief. Or rather, that the people who I'm playing with aren't the Chief, and they start hitting, you know, this is just too much, and it makes it all the more urgent for us to get Virgil out of there, because he has some secret that Dare is telling us is so important, and et cetera, et cetera. And maybe that would have made it a bit more, you know.
I would have liked that. I've talked a number of times, I think even going back to the Halo 2 area, about wanting to have non-death related punishments. In other words, you know, success or failure in these things is almost always binary, right? And when they switched from the health pack system over to the rechargeable shields, it just reinforced that. I've always noticed that, you know, even on areas where if you're having a tough time playing, a lot of times what happens is that either you die or you escape unscathed completely. And of course, the Halo 3 shield system just reinforces that, because although you have a health level, you can't see it and it's not significant. The most significant protection you have is the shield. The shield recharges more quickly and fully. And so, you know, no matter how tough the last situation was, you're always completely fine when you go into the next one. So it just becomes binary. Every sequence is either a complete success or a complete failure. Failure is death. Death leads to a repeat. I would have really liked to see them do something like what they did with Mass Effect 2. You know, the final sequence of that, which is exactly as you describe, right? You spend the first, you know, two-thirds of the game collecting a team that you're going to use in the last segment of the game. And depending on, you know, your execution and your choices. Now, in that case, of course, what happens is, it's not directly within your control.
Right.
It's still kind of arbitrary, right? The characters who die, it's based on your previous actions and your choices. It's not based on your combat execution, because the players that you, you know, the characters that you take with you into those combat segments, it still treats like a normal combat thing. Those characters don't die; they're knocked down. As long as you win, they'll be revived.
Right, they come back up.
Right, but it's possible for other characters to die. So, you know, you can lose almost everybody, or you can lose just some people or just one person, but you still get through the game. I think, yeah, it would have been interesting if, for instance, the only characters whose death would cause a repeat in the final segments of ODST would be you as the rookie or Virgil as the objective. But it might have been nice to have an area where, okay, let's say on the coastal highway that maybe you could get everybody there alive, or maybe it could be just you and the engineer, and that would make it even harder. You know, if you play well on that section, then you have everybody to help you at the end. And if you don't play well on that section, then it's just you. That's another area, of course, where things are a little bit broken by the fact that you can get a tank into the last sequence.
Oh, you can? All the way in?
Yeah, on co-op, you can actually bring... I can't remember now. I'll have to check my film. I know that you can get a Warthog all the way in.
Oh, okay.
And you get it by pushing the tank. On co-op, basically, you bring a tank and a Warthog down into that area, and you can use the tank to push the Warthog over using a car as a ramp.
Okay.
You can push a Gauss Warthog into that area, and that drastically changes, you know, the nature of that last segment, which is, you know, it's really, really hard, at least it was for me. I'm, you know, as an elite player, was pretty challenging on Legendary. And once you add in a vehicle, the balance really changes drastically.
And now you give me a reason to try it again.
To replay. I don't remember if we were able to push the tank all the way in, but I do know that you can push it far enough in. So what happens is that you want to make sure that they don't garbage collect it. So the best thing to do actually is that you have to send somebody in to trigger the next segment.
Right.
But you have to leave somebody. You have to leave somebody behind.
Somebody has to stay in the turret, or
yeah. Uh-huh. If you hang the tank over the barrier there, what you can do is that you can send somebody after the cutscene and the next sequence starts. You can send somebody back to the tank and get in the gun, and he can use the gun. And what happens is the Phantoms come in and they drop down guys like right in front of the tank, and
right,
just blow them up immediately, and, which is fun. I mean, you can't call it challenging,
right?
But it is fun.
You're right, right. That's interesting. Well, we kind of veered off into the last level there. I don't know if you want to go back to the we touched on Kazingo. And then I guess there's the Oni Alpha. Oni Alpha is a good level.
Well, I tell you what, I really liked the scenario. I mean, there's not a lot of scenarios like that. You know, the there's plenty of bridges, but the idea of getting over a bridge before blowing it, I think, though, that's one of those sequences that it works really well when you do everything that Bungie expects you to do when they expect you to do it.
Right.
If you veer off, it becomes a lot less enjoyable. Like, for instance, the bridge will blow whether you blow it or not.
Uh-huh.
And I don't like that.
That's even if you, but that's if you cross over the bridge. I think that's
actually
one of those...
even if you stay on it, it'll eventually blow.
Oh, I thought that was one of those challenges where people said, you know, don't cross the bridge, stay on that side and try to hit those, you know, hit the banshees and the wraiths.
No, you can end up, you can, if you're good enough, or if you just play on a lower difficulty level, you can actually go forward over the bridge and end up on the other side. But the bridge will blow anyway, and then the cutscene brings you back to the other side.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, that's another thing where, you know, as long as you react the way Bungie expects you to, you know, you see all these guys coming over the bridge and you see the tanks on the other side and you run back. But, of course, Mickey is telling you to, you know, to arm the charges. But it doesn't matter if you arm them or not. You can, you can run away and then go up into the tower, right? And after you've set all the charges, you're supposed to push the button on the terminal to blow them. And there's a Marine there who's urging you to do that. It doesn't matter if you do any of that. If you don't set the charges and you don't hit the button, you just wait long enough and the bridge will blow anyway.
But do they give you any sort of storyline excuse? Does somebody say, don't worry, I'll take care of it, or forget about it, I'll take care of it?
I don't recall.
I wonder if that's...
It just blows anyway.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, some of the most fun ways to play that is to play against their expectation. It's just that the results are just so out of character. You know, like you spend all this effort fighting your way to the other side of the bridge, and then, oops, all of a sudden, you know, that wasn't supposed to happen. I mean, I would have liked it if you could have had a couple of different outcomes. I mean, obviously, if you defeat all the forces, you don't need to blow the bridge, right? I mean, or at least they could have waited until you crossed back to the other side and then said, okay, now we're going to blow the bridge so nobody can follow us, you know, because who knows, another Covenant team might come back, you know, and they would try again. Like a lot of the sequences, right, Bungie will give you a thing that's fun and then they will punish you. You know, they'll give you a tank and then they take it away and they lock you in an area where because that's how Kazingo ends, right? You get the tank at the beginning of Kazingo. You drive through some areas, you get to blow up a lot of stuff. Then they take the tank away, they lock the door behind you, and a bunch of phantoms come in and loads a bunch of guys where you've got kind of limited ammo and there's nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. You can also cheat and you can bring vehicles into that area using the same trick. And here they do the same thing, right? The bridge scenario is kind of fun. It's not really hard, you know, in and of itself. You don't really need to defeat everybody. If you just follow the sequence of actions, you can blow the bridge and that does the job for you. But then they do the same thing, right? They give you another area where you retreat up a hill and you have to do a series of defenses. And there's, you know, all these guys coming at you. They offer you these fixed gun positions that are basically just, you know,
targets.
Yeah, exactly. They're targets. They would trick you like, here's a gun. Go ahead. Try and use it.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
stay in this one spot.
Yeah.
Right. But don't you think this is also, they kind of do a nice job, and maybe I'm forgetting the other stages, the previous ones, but this is a really nice lead into Firefight. You know, it kind of showing you that sort of, we got to stay here for X amount of minutes. I think
it depends how much you like Firefight. I know, for instance, again, maybe I'll channel Cody for a bit, but if I remember Cody's take on it was that what they really did was that they didn't do enough encounter design. And so what they do is that they just throw in a Firefight scenario where they make you play Firefight for a little bit because they can't think of anything else because they didn't actually design an encounter. I mean, I'm not saying that's how I feel about it, but I think that's probably fair to say that that's the way he feels about it, that a lot of it, you know, levels either end or begin with a Firefight sequence, which is basically just, okay, now we're going to lock you in a contained area and we're going to drop waves of enemies at you in increasing number, right, and increasing difficulty.
Right.
His
one point that I, when he finally explained it to me, I said, I could kind of see that, is that there's no, like, there was never any, there wasn't enough attention paid to height. So when you are mm-hmm. stuck in these, the situations, you're basically always looking in just the same XY, or maybe it's XZ, but there's no up and down. There's no like level, like, oh, now look up high and snipe from, you know, from up, you know, up there, or look down. And I think that's kind of what he was saying. I think especially when he was talking about, the actual streets of Mombasa,
right?
That, you know, right, that it was just too lateral, I guess.
I think there had to be a technical reason for that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Right. The only Halo levels that really have that is what the shaft in Silent Cartographer. You know, where you've got long vertical distances where you can actually, you know, you can actually have combat, you know, these spiral staircases and these kinds of areas. Halo 2 really doesn't have areas like that.
Halo 3 had that with the jackals up in the trees. I guess
right.
Maybe that
but
was
even,
a little bit.
But even there. So, I think that's not as deep as the shaft. I mean, there's those two long drops you can make in the shaft where you can actually see enemies that are directly below you a long distance away.
I see what you mean. Right.
And yeah, there's not. I don't know why that is. Maybe they found, for instance, that the AI was very good at handling that because, you know, for the AI, all directions are the same. You mm-hmm. know, an AI doesn't feel any differently looking horizontally than it does looking vertically.
Right.
But for a person, you know, I think there's something different psychologically about how you feel about when you're shooting, you know, through a spiral staircase as opposed to, you know, shooting horizontally.
Right.
I'm not really sure. I can't say that really bothered me, but yeah, you're right. A lot of the verticality in ODST is over long distances. You know, it's fighting up hills or defending the top of a hill.
Right.
And that's of course what we're doing in the end of the Oni Alpha site. We're actually in the middle of it, right? Because
right.
we go from the bridge to the hill defense, and then we're inside the building
and
they're
the
coming in. So we're kind of. It's not really a steep incline, but then we're in a little bowl, and the enemies have height
yeah.
advantage, and they're coming down at you. That middle sequence, the hill sequence, is another one really where it's best to play it against expectations, right? Because they expect you to, you know, run up the hill and then to defend it from the top. And then what happens is that then at the bottom of the hill, you know, the Phantoms come in and they drop units and they drop a couple of tanks. And they don't give you any, you know, just like the previous sequence, they give you tanks and no anti-tank weapons.
Right.
You know, they've got the turrets, but you can't really use them. You break them off, you don't really have enough ammo to do anything, and there are multiple tanks, which means it's difficult to approach them one by one. They almost want to. I always felt that they really wanted you to make you retreat in that sequence. You know, they're constantly urging you to get inside the building once the doors open. And not to fight your way out of that scenario. But if you resist, I mean, if you don't run up the hill, you know, run up the hill just far enough to trigger a checkpoint and then run back down, you
can hijack a tank.
Yeah, exactly. You can attack the tanks from behind, and it's
right.
really the best way to do it. You can hijack
right.
them, or you can just destroy them. Even just a plasma pistol, you know, you can stop it from turning around, and
mm-hmm.
then they can't shoot you. And it's a lot easier to do it that way.
Right. Well, that's so, and then that leads into the what I was just saying is one of my favorites, the headquarters, the NMPD, and that's where we finally. Well, not only is it one of the fun, it actually has one of the better cutscenes, where we actually get to see some fighting at the end. You were talking about that, you know, the earlier where the sniper gets bent.
Right,
and the brute chieftain comes down. That actually was one of the few, I guess, where they actually the animators did a really good job of choreographing a fight scene between something that was so you know I up until then you know the whole scale of a brute, especially a chieftain, and the ODST, it kind of you couldn't really see it, but here you kind of really saw you know how many guys was it like four guys had to take this guy. This brute down, and he had the upper hand all the way up until the end there.
Get this thing off of me!
How bad?
Not good!
We're gonna get you out of here.
Not by air, we're not.
It's all right. I know another way.
Now that's a good scene. For me, I think I can just kind of respect the fact that Bungie doesn't hardly ever, within the context of all the Halo games, put combat into cutscenes. I kind of respect that. I think they treat that combat as gameplay. When there's a combat event that affects the outcome of the game, that you should be able to play it. You shouldn't have to watch a battle turn out one way or the other. And that's, I think, one of the only places I can think of where you do see that happen, where, you know, you're in the middle of a battle and you don't finish the battle and a cutscene takes over. I felt a little disoriented with that, because there's also no way to prevent it, right? I mean, you spend the entire end sequence, and that's also one of the better levels, I think, in the game as well. If you happen to like missile pods and blowing up fans, right, which is probably my favorite thing in all the games to do. But there's also no way to avoid that sequence. You know, no matter how many, you know, there's no way to take that guy out before he lands on the platform.
Right, yeah. It is the whole blowing up of the Phantoms is, I think, one of the few like instances where you can actually shortcut a scene, or, well, not a scene, but the level, legally. You know, if you're fast enough and you can get enough shots and you're co-oping, you got enough guys with you, you can quickly take out those Phantoms, and it's actually quite the right.
And then you don't have to fight the troops on the platform,
right?
Because they never get there.
The reward for doing it has always really been, not only is it a good visual effect, but the sound effect, and then hearing all the elites, you know, crash and die. It was always a lot of fun, and so that's why I kind of like that. You know, and that fight scene kind of makes me, once I saw the Reach trailer, or one of the Reach trailers, I was like, oh, look at this! They're giving that same attention to the hand-to-hand combat is being put into Reach. Because
that's the first time you see that.
Yeah. You know, I think that in some ways it was always one of my something that I just grew to accept, is that when you're doing, you know, the punch to the neck or any of that stuff, it was always it's always the same kind of animation. And, you know, once they said, oh, well, now you're going to be able to make films, like, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if they did some variations there, you know, like maybe not while you're playing, but as you're watching the film, you know, you see the legs do some interesting moves, you know, as they...
You mean like in Gears?
Yeah, exactly. Just like in Gears. But anyway, yeah, that's a good level. It has some repetition, because you're basically just climbing up, you know, going up the station, or maybe not climbing up, but just managing your way over to wherever the last scene is at.
Right. Well, the areas are, I mean, the architecture is repetitive, but the encounters really aren't. I would say it's one of the better levels for me gameplay wise. It's actually, and it's also those two areas that are my favorite in Firefight. Firefight, I mean, I really like the idea of Firefight, and I'm really not sure that the implementation it got in ODST was as good as it could have been. Some of those areas are much better than others. For instance, the Tayari Plaza firefight area, I really, really dislike. But the Uplift Preserve one and the one that's based on this level, I think are really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
That'll do it for this episode of Anger, Sadness, and Envy, the RampantSea.net podcast. Tune in next time. We'll do a preview of the upcoming Halo Reach multiplayer public beta coming May 3rd.
I guess in the meantime, if you want to...
In the meantime, we can talk about how your favorite game, Gears of War, will have underwater missions in the third episode. You read
I haven't even been following that stuff.
I'm just reading it now.
Is it underwater in a closet? Is that...
I don't know. It says underwater missions as well as radical changes to the much-loved cover system.
That's interesting. I wonder if they even acknowledge any of that. Like, if they maybe in their world they don't see that, not even a concern that it's all fakery. The sort of long views and stuff. It's that you can never walk further than a virtual 100 feet or something.
I think they acknowledge the fact that most people wouldn't ever go there, even if you could. Like, I think there are plenty of people who play Halo just like it was Gears. Areas where there's not a gameplay scenario that plays out. I mean, in Halo, you can go to plenty of places where there are no enemies and there are no encounters. It's just off in the distance. You could go there, but there's nothing to do there. And then even, the barriers and the other areas you're not supposed to be able to get, you can get there. Even though, again, there's nothing to do and nothing to see there. I think what Epic realizes is that, 95% or whatever of people don't ever bother to do that. And so, well, why even render it? Why make it? Just make it a, make it a backdrop.